I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we explore global happiness with the chief editor of the World Happiness Report himself. Dr. John Helliwell is professor emeritus in the Vancouver School of Economics at the University of British Columbia and a distinguished senior fellow at the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. But he's most famous for bringing both academia and the public the World Happiness Report. John, welcome to the podcast.
It's good to be here.
Let's begin with a little bit about you first. You didn't start out studying happiness. You're an economist. So tell us how an economist ends up studying happiness around the world.
It shouldn't be a surprise. Two centuries ago, economists were convinced that happiness ought to be the goal of human action, but couldn't think of ways of measuring it. So as the profession developed, it started to concentrate more on things that were measured, and that put a focus on material production and things like GDP, which then became measures of social progress. It was a little more than 20 years ago when I discovered that there were actually measures made of how happy people were with their lives. And as Aristotle said two millennia ago, to have people value their own lives is the fundamental way of finding out how their lives are going. And so I thought that was right, and these data were there. So then I pivoted from trying to pretend I knew about what made people happy into using these direct measures. And the more time I spent with them, the more realistic they seem to be, and of course, very democratic as well, because these are people themselves evaluating their lives. And then that set up a whole development of the modern science of well-being, treating these measures of life evaluations, and as in this Gallup emotional report, emotions as well.
I love how you took it right back to the origin. Because so much of the conversation about happiness, at least the public conversation and in the research, has really changed over decades and generations. But it's living through this pandemic, at which many of us around the world are absolutely still smack dab in the middle of, even though it feels a little different if you're in a couple of economies. Living through the pandemic also really brought the importance of bringing data and research to happiness and life evaluation more than ever. Talk to us about how that paradigm shift has unfolded from your perspective as somebody who's watched this field now for quite a while.
It was very good that we had pushed the science along as far as we have by the time the pandemic came. Otherwise, we would have been extraordinarily puzzled by the resilience of not just the overall life evaluations, but also the emotional measures in the reports. And people couldn't understand because lives had been turned upside down. But because of the research that had been done over the last 20 years, we knew that it was not, should not be a real surprise that people have this resiliency under times of emergency and disaster. We had seen it post-tsunami, we've seen it post-Fukushima, we've seen it in a variety of situations where, with enormous damage, a loss of life, nonetheless, people could find themselves feeling better about their lives and their neighbors. And so that is a puzzle to be unpacked. And our unpacking, which seems to have had echoes in COVID times, was that people really care about living in a society where other people are watching their backs, where they feel trust, they feel trusted, and they can work together for making things better for each other. Well, the best demonstration of that capacity is when things go wrong. And if people rush in to help each other, then not only do they enjoy that, but they change their whole view of their neighbors and their lives and the communities they live in. It's a feature of modern media that we're always told about bad things happening and acts committed by people acting badly. So we have an inflated sense of the evils around us and an underestimate of the extent to which other people are really on our team and working for us. So then we find in previous natural disasters, and especially during COVID, where everything's been turned upside down and a lot of the conventional supports for happy lives are just not there or are there in a substitute form, that people have discovered or rediscovered the essential humanity of their neighbors, of their coworkers, and indeed their families. So we hear about the places where that's gone wrong during COVID. One example, for example, is that someone did a study of whether suicides have gone up or down. And one study was based on newspaper reports of suicide and calculated them in different countries. And they indeed had gone up. But now we've got data from the actual death counts in a lot of countries. A very recent paper in 21 countries found that suicides had gone up and significantly in no country. And in more than half the countries, they'd gone significantly down. And so it shows, and in some sense, what people have found in their own lives is that their neighbors are, they're learning about their immediate neighbors in a way they didn't before, and they're learning about their families, and they're learning that other people will come in and help them and do. And that's a much stronger support for your feeling about your overall life quality than the pivoting from inline connection with your friends to online substitutions and other things that people have emphasized.
I think it's hard not to ask you. You're somebody who has contributed so much really to the area of well-being research over your career. You're now kind of the author of one of the world's most famous reports. The World Happiness Report has really taken on a world of its own. I know it's a compilation of hard work by a large group of people. Tell us about how it felt to do that work in the middle of the lockdown and the pandemic and in times when we saw really, you know, lives turned upside down. Tell us about this, your latest edition of the report, and what were some of the key findings for you?
Well, first of all, a shout out to Gallup for the amazing the skill and speed with which they pivoted the collection of these data from the Gallup World Poll, because of course they had to move from, in three quarters of the countries, move from in-person to online and testing new methods and developing the teams and getting those responses. That was quite extraordinary to be able to do that. And so we were working closely with Gallup on this, and they were extraordinarily good in getting the data in hands. We didn't get quite as big a coverage of the world as we normally do, but almost all the major countries were there, and we ended up with maybe 80% as many countries as normally, a really good coverage of the world. Of course, we didn't know until very late on in this process how things were going to play out. So there was more uncertainty than usual about the structure of the report. And of course, we were also following COVID itself. So a major part of the report this year was to look at alternative strategies for dealing with COVID, separating countries into those that tried to eliminate community transmission and those that didn't. And so that ended up being an important feature of it all. And we were impressed and surprised initially, but as the evidence became stronger and stronger, that in the long run, the countries that were doing better at supporting all aspects of life were not those that thought they could trade off COVID deaths against an open economy, but those that said, you either get both or you get neither. You either control COVID properly and then permit people to get back together again, or you're going to go back and forth from one wave to another and one variant to a worse one. And so that became an important part of this year's report, to assemble the evidence that was becoming clear by the time our report came out, that there was only one right way to deal with this. We will see in 2021 and the surveys that are going to be going on this year, whether that preference for a suppression continued and was an important one. Underlying all this is what we discussed earlier, that how resilient people have been in both their life evaluations and their emotions. And we find this is true even in those countries that did not handle COVID so well. Of course, they had a more chance, if you like, to connect with each other because they were dealing with worse circumstances. Trust turned out to be an important flagship. We've known through the World Happiness Report over its whole 9 years, we've found increasingly that in order to measure and produce this kind of social connection, you really do things that end up building trust with each other and building trust in public institutions. Both are very important. We found during COVID, especially the importance of trust in public institutions, because a lot of the responses have had to come from governments and other public institutions. And if those institutions are trusted, then they're more likely to face a common, connected response in the community, which, of course, for any disasters, that level of social trust produces something that's good for everybody. And if social trust is very low, then the society becomes divided and they end up creating a lot of tension rather than getting good solutions.
Some of the negative emotions data, if I recall, and I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong, were really getting worse before COVID. Obviously, the pandemic kind of set them off the edge for many communities. But as you've studied kind of what makes people happy, you'd also studied what drives unhappiness or you know, those negative experiences. Why do you think they've been on the rise for years? And what do you think is driving that?
The simple answer to that is I don't know. And I'd even say we don't know in the broader research community. It was a nice, not it was a informative part of the Gallup Emotions Report to say at once these negative emotions are at their highest level during the Gallup World Poll measurement of it. But COVID-19 didn't do much to that trend. If you look at 2020, it's right on the same trend that had been established for the previous years. There are a lot of candidates for playing a role in this. The increasing divisiveness you find in the political arena in many countries, increasing levels of inequality. We find, of course, in the Gallup World Poll, the most important inequalities are inequality of well-being itself. And we find that those have been growing over the last decade. It may well be true that the declining importance of in some countries of a common source of information, so that you find even the information sources that people use are more split into us them distinctions. Where that happens, it's much harder to make common cause. It's harder to think of your neighbors as your friends. And that may have been true in a number of countries. In fact, we know it's true. And they may be contributing to these rises in negative emotions. It's worth pointing out on top of that when we look at life evaluations as a whole across countries, and we ask what is the role for positive emotions and negative emotions, which ever since Aristotle, people have said those are going to be an important part of the support for people's lives, we find that looking across countries especially, it's the positive emotions that really count. And of course, this is a whole part of what we've learned through the Gallup World Poll, that the presence of positives is much more important than the absence or presence of negatives. And so we find that the positive emotions count much more into life evaluations than the negative ones do. So that although there's been this steady rise in negative emotions, it hasn't played into an equivalent measure or anything like it in the overall life evaluations that people have.
That's a very profound a nuance and finding. I'm going to ask you this. You're probably the only person on the planet who can even attempt to answer this question. But one question I never know how to answer when we talk about life evaluation research and how people really go through the process of evaluating what is a very complex thing, your life, on a simple scale, when there's so many dimensions to one's life and one's experience in this journey we're all on. The question is, how do you know, or to what degree does somebody's local experience factor into their life evaluation versus how they perceive their experience to be compared to others? I ask this because I started focusing on life evaluation as a researcher really in the Middle East. And what was really fascinating to me is to watch some of these numbers as many of the countries in the Middle East began to see uprisings and demands for more social justice, more, you know, economic equity. And it was a big explanation of that was, well, the world's now connected. People are on, you know, social media. They can see how the developed world is living and their demands are now, you know, rising to those levels. How much of that is true versus it really is just about what's happening with my kids, with my family, with my dog, with my local church or mosque, and really just an assessment of kind of your local experience?
One of the sort of pocket facts that keeps coming up is that life is local, and that what people think about their government or about the world has a very small direct effect on people's answers to that life question compared to how things are going at work, in the family, on the street. And when you think about it, how your life is really does depend not on the novels you're reading or the newspaper headlines you see, but in fact, how you feel connected to those people with whom you work and with whom you relate on the streets. And so if there's the way in which opposition, for example, or separation or conflict affects you, it usually only becomes important to your life evaluation when it shows up on your streets, on your in your workplace, and so on. And of course, that translation can happen, but it's when it happens in your life as you live it that it really starts affecting your life evaluations. There's one more point that helps me to think about this question is as to how people do their scaling when they answer these questions. What are they measuring against? Is that through two parallel surveys, we had measures of people's overall evaluation of their health on a 5-point, nice 5-point scale. And we found there's a continual drop in that health evaluation as you go through your life. So the number of health problems obviously is increasing. So the average score drops on a fairly linear plane right across. So then is that because of people thinking about things differently or what's going on here? A second survey asked people, how do you rate your health on that same scale relative to other people your age? Now you see, you're then asking them, do they understand their own health and are they capable and good at valuing that relative to other people? And sure enough, the answers to that question showed no trend with age. So that kind of evidence gives you enormous respect for people's abilities to value something as subjective as your life or your health in a way that's very accurate, in a sense that the actual physical characteristics that people measure in health do follow that general trend, but they understand perfectly that that's part of life. And when they compare themselves to other people like them, then that measure does not go down at all. So it means people are listening when you ask them that questions. They pay attention to what you're asking, and they know how to give appropriate answers.
That's just the perfect note to end on. That's Dr. John Helliwell, editor of the World Happiness Report and professor at the University of British Columbia. John, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. You can see I enjoy talking about happiness.
That's our show. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe and stay up to date with our latest conversations, just search for the Gallup Podcast wherever you podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us on Twitter at Gallup News. If you have suggestions for the show, email podcast@gallup.com. The Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.